Through six decades of academic and popular writing, Skinner would insist that further investigation is always possible. In the first pages of Beyond Freedom and Dignity, he calls for a technological solution to ignorance. We need to make vast changes in human behavior, and we cannot make them with the help of nothing more than physics or biology, no matter how hard we try. What we need is a technology of behavior, comparable in power and precision to physical and biological technology. Skinner imagined technologies that would pervasively institutionalize the viewpoint of the other one as they observed, computed, analyzed, and automatically reinforced behavior to accomplish the vast changes that he believed were necessary. In this way, the laws of human action would finally be illuminated so that behavior could be effectively predicted and shaped, just as other technologies had enabled physics and biology to change the world. The difference is that the instruments and methods they use are of commensurate complexity. The fact that equally powerful instruments and methods are not available in the field of human behavior is not an explanation. It is only part of the puzzle. Skinner concluded that the literature of freedom and dignity stands in the way of further human achievement. He argued that the missing puzzle piece holding back the urgent development of the instruments and methods essential for a technology of behavior was the stubborn allegiance to these antique notions among people determined to preserve due credit for their actions. The belief in autonomous man is a regressive source of resistance to a rational future, an alternative explanation of behavior that obstructs the advancement of society. The professor believed that humanity desperately needed a plan, and he imagined powerful new instruments that could engineer behavior in every domain. As early as 1953, he anticipated today's digitally engineered casino environments, whose sophistication in the precise shaping of gamblers' behavior has made them a testing ground for state security agencies and surveillance capitalists alike. But with proper instrumentation, it should be possible to improve upon established practices in all these fields. Thus, gambling devices could be improved, from the point of view of the proprietor, by introducing devices which would pay off on a variable interval basis, but only when the rate of play is exceptionally high. Technologies of behavioral engineering would not be restricted to devices, but would also encompass organizational systems and procedures designed to shape behavior toward specific ends. In 1953, Skinner anticipated innovations such as Michael Jensen's incentive systems designed to maximize shareholder value and the choice architectures of behavioral economics designed to nudge behavior along a preferred path. Schedules of pay in industry, salesmanship, and the professions, and the use of bonuses, incentive wages, and so on, could also be improved from the point of view of generating maximal productivity. Skinner understood that the engineering of behavior risked violating individual sensibilities and social norms, especially concerns about privacy. In order to allay these anxieties, he advised that observation must be unobtrusive, ideally remaining outside the awareness of the organism. Behavior may also be observed with a minimum of interaction between subject and scientist, and this is the case with which one naturally tries to begin. But there would be challenges. New technologies of behavior would have to continually push the envelope of the public-private divide in order to access all the data relevant to behavioral prediction and control. In this, he anticipated today's rendition frontier as new detection systems plumb the depths of personalities and emotions. But we are still faced with events which occur at the private level and which are important to the organism without instrumental amplification. How the organism reacts to these events will remain an important question, even though the events may someday be made accessible to everyone. Such conflicts would be resolved, Skinner reckoned, by the gradual retreat of privacy norms as they fall to the advance of knowledge. The line between public and private is not fixed. Like today's surveillance capitalists, he was confident that the slow drip of technological invention would eventually push privacy to the margins of human experience, where it would join freedom and other troublesome illusions. All these would be replaced by the viewpoint of the other one, embodied in new instruments and methods. The boundary shifts with every discovery of a technique for making private events public. The problem of privacy may therefore eventually be solved by technical advances. Although privacy advocates and many other critics of surveillance capitalism are quick to appropriate Orwellian language in the search for meaning and metaphor that capture the sense of new menace, surveillance capital's instrumentarian power is best understood as the precise antithesis of Orwell's Big Brother. We now turn to this stark contrast, most vividly represented in the distinct conceptions of utopia that attach to each of these two species of power. 7. Two Utopias. In the blood-soaked wake of World War II, both Skinner and the journalist and novelist George Orwell aimed curative utopian novels at the mayhem of modernity's diminished prospects produced by an incomprehensible scale of violence. Viewed from a distance, Skinner's Walden 2, published in 1948, and Orwell's 1984, released the following year, had much in common. Each elaborated a complete conception of a distinct logic of power. Each imagined a society defined by the full flourishing of that power, and each was utopian from the point of view of the form of power that it described. However, their public reception could not have been more different. Walden, too, was dismissed as a dystopian nightmare and ignored by the general public for more than a decade. Orwell's 1984 was immediately canonized as a dystopian masterpiece and the distillation of the 20th century's worst nightmares. The two utopias have often been confused with each other in their content and aims. Time magazine's 1971 cover story on Skinner described Walden 2 as raising the specter of a 1984 Orwellian society that might really come to pass. The great historian and literary critic Lewis Mumford once described Walden 2 as a totalitarian utopia and a depiction of hell. But in fact, these characterizations are a persistent and, as we shall see, dangerous confusion. Although both books have been described as depictions of totalitarianism, the forms of power that each describes are profoundly different. In most respects, they are precise opposites. Meyer's prescription for modernity was founded on the scientific objectification of human experience and its reduction to observable, measurable behavior. If we take that as our benchmark here, then Orwell's utopia is the before case. It precedes Meyer as a nightmare of the pre-scientific compulsion to dominate the soul. Skinner's utopia is after Meyer's reimagining of modernity, as channeled from the great physicist Planck. Walden 2 is built on Meyer's scientific viewpoint of observation, the other one, and represents the full flower of Meyer's hope for a scientifically induced global harmony of organisms in which freedom is necessarily forfeit to knowledge. Orwell laid bare the disease, and Skinner asserted the antidote. The totalitarian power elaborated in 1984 is something wholly unprecedented, concocted in the 20th century from the collision of industrialism and despair, a form utterly new to the human story. Orwell did more than simply fictionalize and extrapolate the totalitarian project. He sounded an alert by drawing a terrifying line of consequence from the recent German past and persistent Soviet present to an imagined but all too possible future. His genius was to craft a story that embodied totalitarianism's essence, the ruthless insistence upon the absolute possession of each individual human being, not as a distant other known only by its behavior, but rather from the inside out. Big Brother's vigilance is not restricted to the grand continents of armies and statecraft or the observable flows of bodies and crowds. Big Brother is a pervasive consciousness that infects and possesses each individual soul, displacing all attachments once formed in romantic love and good fellowship. The essence of its operation is not simply that it knows every thought and feeling, but rather the ruthless tenacity with which it aims to annihilate and replace unacceptable inward experience. We are not content with negative obedience, nor even with the most abject submission, the cunning henchman O'Brien tells the rebellious Winston. We shall crush you down to the point from which there is no coming back. When finally you surrender to us, it must be of your own free will. We do not destroy the heretic because he resists us. So long as he resists us, we never destroy him. We convert him. We capture his inner mind. We reshape him. We bring him over to our side, not in appearance, but genuinely, heart and soul. We make him one of ourselves before we kill him. Ultimately, as every reader knows, Winston's stubborn soul is successfully engineered. Orwell's chilling final passages fulfill the life of that dry seed planted at the turn of the century in Italy's impoverished soil and nourished by war, deprivation, and humiliation to flower in the nightmare of Nazi Germany and the apocalypse of Stalin's Russia, finally to bear fruit in Orwell's imagination. A testament for all time to what Mussolini had called the ferocious totalitarian will, and the souls on which it feeds. Winston basks in serene elation, his soul white as snow. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother. In contrast, Walden 2 was not intended as a warning, but rather as the antidote to totalitarianism and, more broadly, a practical recipe for the challenges of rebuilding Western societies after the war. Skinner understood his utopia as a methodological cure for the nightmare of crushed souls, a cure that he insisted was superior to any of the conventional political, economic, or spiritual remedies on offer. He scoffed at the notion that democracy held the solution because it is a political system that merely perpetrates the illusion of freedom while impeding the dominion of science. The promise of the free market as the curative for post-war society was an equally empty dream, he believed, because it rewards destructive competitiveness between people and classes. Skinner also rejected existentialism's new humanism, seeing it as a breeding ground for passivity, and he regarded religion as the worst cure of all, enshrining ignorance and crippling the advance of science. Skinner's cure was different and unique. A utopia of technique that promised a future of social equality and dispassionate harmony, founded on the viewpoint of the other one, the organism among organisms, as the object of behavioral engineering. It is the future of Myers' dreams, in which Fraser, the founder leader of the fictional Walden 2, and Skinner's outspoken avatar, describes that ideal community as a superorganism that can be shaped and controlled as smoothly and efficiently as champion football teams. Skinner's utopia was meant to illustrate the possibility of a successful social order that transcends the use of force and rejects the need to dominate human souls. The Walden 2 community equally disdains the practices of democratic politics and representative government. Its laws are derived from a science of human behavior, specifically Skinner's own radical behaviorism, founded on the physicist's ideal of the other one. His utopia was a vehicle for other ambitions as well, intended to illustrate the behavioral solutions that are essential for improvement in every domain of modern life. The nuclear threat, pollution, population control, urban growth, economic equality, crime, education, healthcare, the development of the individual, effective leisure. It aimed to cultivate the good life for which all the ideals of a liberal society, freedom, autonomy, privacy, a people's right to self-rule, must be forfeit. Walden 2's fictional format provided the cover that Skinner needed to extrapolate from Meyer's methodological principles of otherness and his own research on animal behavior to a utopian community in which behavior has replaced the human spirit as the locus of control. Fraser laments that people have been kept in their places, not just by external forces, but much more subtly by a system of beliefs implanted within their skins. It's sometimes an almost hopeless task to take the shackles off their souls, but it can be done. You can't, in the long run, enforce anything. We don't use force. All we need is adequate behavioral engineering. These two utopias reflect two distinct species of power, and each novel was intent on rescuing the future from the 20th century nightmare of the soul. Orwell was able to draw on the recent past, but Skinner imagined a future that he would not live long enough to enjoy. If surveillance capitalism and its instrumentarian power continue to flourish, then it is we who may see the Walden 2 vision realized, as freedom falls to others' knowledge, but now in the service of others' wealth and power. Skinner's vision is brought to life in the relentless pursuit of surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives and the ubiquitous digital apparatus that surveillance capitalism creates and harnesses to its novel aims. Instrumentarian power bends the new digital apparatus, continuous, autonomous, omnipresent, sensate, computational, actuating, networked, internet-enabled, to the interests of the surveillance capitalist project, finally fulfilling Skinner's call for the instruments and methods of a behavioral technology comparable in power and precision to physical and biological technology. The result is a pervasive means of behavioral modification whose economies of action are designed to maximize surveillance revenues. Until the rise of surveillance capitalism, the prospect of instrumentarian power was relegated to a gauzy world of dream and delusion. This new species of power follows the logic of Planck, Meyer, and Skinner in the forfeit of freedom for knowledge, but those scientists each failed to anticipate the actual terms of this surrender. The knowledge that now displaces our freedom is proprietary. The knowledge is theirs, but the lost freedom belongs solely to us. With this origin story in hand, Chapter 13 turns to a close examination of instrumentarian power, as it inscribes a sharp new asymmetry on the human community. The knowledge to which we sacrifice our freedom is constructed to advance surveillance capitalists' commercial interests, not our own. This is a stark departure from the technical origins of the apparatus in McKay's Principles of Telemetry, which traded animals' freedom for the sake of scientific knowledge intended to benefit the animals themselves. Instead, surveillance capitalism's behavioral market regime finally has at its disposal the instruments and methods that can impose Skinner's technology of behavior across the varied domains of everyday life, right down to our depths. Now conceived as capital's global laboratory. Chapter 13. Big Other and the Rise of Instrumentarian Power. He was their servant, some say he was blind, who moved among their faces and their things. Their feeling gathered in him like a wind and sang. They cried, "It is a god that sings." W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 7. 1. Instrumentarianism as a New Species of Power. Surveillance capitalism is the puppet master that imposes its will through the medium of the ubiquitous digital apparatus. I now name the apparatus Big Other. It is the sensate, computational, connected puppet that renders, monitors, computes, and modifies human behavior. Big Other combines these functions of knowing and doing to achieve a pervasive and unprecedented means of behavioral modification. Surveillance capitalism's economic logic is directed through Big Other's vast capabilities to produce instrumentarian power, replacing the engineering of souls with the engineering of behavior. Instrumentarian power cultivates an unusual way of knowing that combines the formal indifference of the neoliberal worldview with the observational perspective of radical behaviorism. Thanks to Big Other's capabilities, instrumentarian power reduces human experience to measurable, observable behavior while remaining steadfastly indifferent to the meaning of that experience. I call this new way of knowing radical indifference. It is a form of observation without witness that yields the obverse of an intimate, violent, political religion and bears an utterly different signature of havoc. The remote and abstracted contempt of impenetrably complex systems and the interests that author them, carrying individuals on a fast-moving current to the fulfillment of others' ends. What passes for social relations and economic exchange now occurs across the medium of this robotized veil of abstraction. Instrumentarianism's radical indifference is operationalized in Big Other's dehumanized methods of evaluation that produce equivalence without equality. These methods reduce individuals to the lowest common denominator of sameness, an organism among organisms, despite all the vital ways in which we are not the same. From Big Other's point of view, we are strictly other ones, organisms that behave. Big Other encodes the viewpoint of the other one as a global presence. There is no brother here of any kind, big or little, evil or good. There are no family ties, however grim. There is no relationship between Big Other and its otherized objects. Just as there was no relationship between B.F. Skinner's scientists and subjects. There is no domination of the soul that displaces all intimacy and attachment with terror. Far better to let a multitude of relationships bloom. Big Other does not care what we think, feel, or do, as long as its millions, billions, and trillions of sensate, actuating, computational eyes and ears can observe, render, datafy, and instrumentalize the vast reservoirs of behavioral surplus that are generated in the galactic uproar of connection and communication. In this new regime, objectification is the moral milieu in which our lives unfold. Although Big Other can mimic intimacy through the tireless devotion of the one voice, Amazon Alexa's chirpy service, Google Assistant's reminders and endless information. Do not mistake these soothing sounds for anything other than the exploitation of your needs. I think of elephants, that most majestic of all mammals. Big Other poaches our behavior for surplus and leaves behind all the meaning lodged in our bodies, our brains, and our beating hearts, not unlike the monstrous slaughter of elephants for ivory. Forget the cliché that if it's free, you are the product. You are not the product. You are the abandoned carcass. The product derives from the surplus that is ripped from your life. Big Other finally enables the universal technology of behavior that, as Skinner, Stuart McKay, Mark Weiser, and Joe Paradiso each insisted, accomplishes its aims quietly and persistently, using methods that intentionally bypass our awareness, disappearing into the background of all things. Recall that Alphabet Google's Eric Schmidt provoked an uproar in 2015 when, in response to a question on the future of the web, he said, "The Internet will disappear." What he really meant was that the Internet will disappear into Big Other. Thanks to Big Other's capabilities, instrumentarian power aims for a condition of certainty without terror in the form of guaranteed outcomes. Because it does not claim our bodies for some grotesque regime of pain and murder, we are prone to undervalue its effects and lower our guard. Instead of death, torture, re-education, or conversion, Instrumentarianism effectively exiles us from our own behavior. It severs our insides from our outsides, our subjectivity and interiority from our observable actions. It lends credibility to the behavioral economist's hypothesis of the frailty of human reason by making it so, as otherized behavior takes on a life of its own that delivers our futures to surveillance capitalism's aims and interests. In an instrumentarian utopia, Big Other simulates the vortex of stimuli, transforming natural selection into the unnatural selection of variation and reinforcement authored by market players and the competition for surveillance revenues. We may confuse Big Other with the behaviorist god of the vortex, but only because it effectively conceals the machinations of surveillance capital that are the wizard behind the digital curtain. The seductive voice crafted on the yonder side of this veil, "Google, is that you?" gently nudges us along the path that coughs up the maximum of behavioral surplus and the closest approximation to certainty. Do not slumber in this opiated fog at the network's edge. That knowing voice is underwritten by the aims and rules of the very place we once hoped to flee, with its commercialized rituals of competition, contempt, and humiliation. Take one wrong step, one deviation from the path of seamless, frictionless predictability, and that same voice turns acid in an instant as it instructs the vehicular monitoring system not to allow the car to be started. Under the regime of instrumentarian power, the mental agency and self-possession of the right to the future tense are gradually submerged beneath a new kind of automaticity. A lived experience of stimulus-response reinforcement, aggregated as the comings and goings of mere organisms. Our conformity is irrelevant to instrumentarianism's success. There is no need for mass submission to social norms, no loss of self to the collective induced by terror and compulsion, no offers of acceptance and belonging as a reward for bending to the group. All of that is superseded by a digital order that thrives within things and bodies, transforming volition into reinforcement and action into conditioned response. In this way, instrumentarian power produces endlessly accruing knowledge for surveillance capitalists and endlessly diminishing freedom for us as it continuously renews surveillance capitalism's domination of the division of learning in society. False consciousness is no longer produced by the hidden facts of class and their relation to production, but rather by the hidden facts of instrumentarian power's command over the division of learning in society as it usurps the rights to answer the essential questions: who knows, who decides, who decides who decides. Power was once identified with the ownership of the means of production, but it is now identified with ownership of the means of behavioral modification that is Big Other. 2. A market project of total certainty. Big Other and the instrumentarian power that it enables fulfill Skinner's vision for humankind. As early as 1948 in Walden 2, Skinner had pined for the new measurement and computational capabilities that would unlock the mysteries of the vortex of stimuli and illuminate those acts of ignorance that we foolishly value as free will. I didn't say that behavior is always predictable, any more than the weather is always predictable, says Fraser, Walden 2's protagonist. There are often too many factors to be taken into account. We can't measure them all accurately, and we couldn't perform the mathematical operations needed to make a prediction if we had the measurements. It was Skinner's hard destiny to foresee the possibility of instrumentarian power and its operationalization in Big Other, before the instruments existed to fulfill that vision. His lab had always been a fantasy world of engineering innovations for his behavioral experiments, mazes and boxes for animal conditioning, measurement tools and recording devices. A fully operational technology of behavior was the prize that would elude Skinner in his lifetime, a source of frustration that was palpable in every article and lecture right to the end. though confident that science would eventually overcome the practical challenges of a behavioral technology. Skinner was more troubled by the cultural impediments to a human science of behavioral prediction and control, founded on the viewpoint of the other one. He resented the friction produced by human beings in their stubborn attachment to the values and ideals of freedom inherited from the 18th century philosophers, and he equally despised the existential project of the post-war philosophies that planted authenticity, free will, and autonomous action at the heart of second modernity yearning. In his penultimate essay, written in 1990, barely 3 years before his death, Skinner mourned the prospects of behavioral prediction as the foundation of a new society built on scientific certainty. To say that a person is simply a place in which something happens seems even more threatening when it raises questions about what we are likely to do rather than what we have done. In those last years, he seemed more resigned to the tenacity of human friction and its stubborn allegiance to something like free will. His voice less outrageous and aggressive than the author of Beyond Freedom and Dignity 2 decades earlier. Anger and contempt had shaded into weariness and despair with his final reflections. It may be said that this is a discouraging view of human behavior, and that we shall be more likely to do something about the future if we continue to believe that our destiny is in our hands. That belief has survived for many centuries, and has led to remarkable achievements. But the achievements were only the immediate consequences of what was done. We now know that other consequences have followed, and that they are threatening our future. What we have done with our destiny may not be a testament we wish to leave to the world. In our time of surveillance exceptionalism, as astonishment succumbs to helplessness and resignation, the resistance that Skinner lamented appears to be waning. The belief that we can choose our destiny is under siege, and in a dramatic reversal, the dream of a technology of behavioral prediction and control, for which Skinner had endured such public scorn, is now a flourishing fact. This prize now attracts immense capital, human genius, scientific elaboration, governmental protection, ecosystems of institutionalization, and the glamour that always has and always will attach to power. The rise of instrumentarianism follows the path of illuminating events that, as Hannah Arendt writes, reveal a beginning in the past which had hitherto been hidden. It is in the nature of instrumentarian power to operate remotely and move in stealth. It does not grow through terror, murder, the suspension of democratic institutions, massacre, or expulsion. Instead, it grows through declaration, self-authorization, rhetorical misdirection, euphemism, and the quiet, audacious backstage moves specifically crafted to elude awareness as it replaces individual freedom with others' knowledge and replaces society with certainty. It does not confront democracy, but rather erodes it from within, eating away at the human capabilities and self-understanding required to sustain a democratic life. The narratives of Facebook's experimental maneuvers, Pokemon Go's prototype of a behavioral futures market-dominated society, and the endless examples of digital innovation crushed under the heel of the surveillance creed may be as close as we get to a public announcement of history-illuminating change that moves through us and among us, irreversibly altering life as we have known it. There is no violence here, only the steady displacement of the will to will that has been embodied in self-determination, expressed in the first-person voice, and nourished in the kind of sanctuary that depends upon the possibility of private life and the promise of public freedom. Instrumentarian power, like Goethe's Faust, is morally agnostic. The only moral imperative here is distilled from the point of view of a thin utopian gruel. If there is sin, it is the sin of autonomy, the audacity to reject the flows that herd us all toward predictability. Friction is the only evil. Obstruction in law, action, or rhetoric is simply reactionary. The norm is submission to the supposed iron laws of technological inevitability that brook no impediment. It is deemed only rational to surrender and rejoice in new conveniences and harmonies, to wrap ourselves in the first text and embrace a violent ignorance of its shadow. Totalitarianism was a transformation of the state into a project of total possession. Instrumentarianism and Big Other signal the transformation of the market into a project of total certainty, an undertaking that is unimaginable outside the digital milieu, but also unimaginable outside the logic of accumulation that is surveillance capitalism. This new power is the spawn of an unprecedented convergence, the surveillance and actuation capabilities of Big Other in combination with the discovery and monetization of behavioral surplus. It is only in the context of this convergence that we can imagine economic principles that instrumentalize and control human experience to systematically and predictably shape behavior toward others' profitable ends. Instrumentarian power operates from the vantage point of the other one to reduce human persons to the mere animal condition of behavior shorn of reflective meaning. It sees only organisms bent to serve the new laws of capital now imposed on all behavior. Arendt anticipated the destructive potential of behaviorism decades ago when she lamented the devolution of our conception of thought to something that is accomplished by a brain and is therefore transferable to electronic instruments. The last stage of the laboring society, the society of job holders, demands of its members a sheer automatic functioning, as though individual life had actually been submerged in the overall life process of the species, and the only active decision still required of the individual were to let go, so to speak, to abandon his individuality, the still individually sensed pain and trouble of living, and acquiesce in a dazed, tranquilized, functional type of behavior. The trouble with modern theories of behaviorism is not that they are wrong, but that they could become true, that they actually are the best possible conceptualization of certain obvious trends in modern society. It is quite conceivable that the modern age, which began with such an unprecedented and promising outburst of human activity, may end in the deadliest, most sterile passivity history has ever known. Is this to be our home? The automation of the self as the necessary condition of the automation of society, and all for the sake of others' guaranteed outcomes? 3. This century's curse. One place to begin our reckoning with this question is in Arendt's concluding remarks in the first edition of The Origins of Totalitarianism, words that have haunted me since I first read them many years ago. They were written at a time when totalitarianism had been defeated in Europe, but remained unchallenged in Stalin's USSR. It was a time when much of the world was united in the urgency of understanding and remembering, not only as testament, but also as a vaccine against future terror. Arendt's reflections summarize not only totalitarianism's futility and ludicrousness, but also her sense of the disturbing relevance of totalitarian regimes. She warned that totalitarianism could not be written off as an accidental turn toward tragedy, but rather that it must be seen as deeply connected with the crisis of this century. She concluded, "The fact is that the true problems of our time cannot be understood, let alone solved, without acknowledgement that totalitarianism became this century's curse only because it so terrifyingly took care of its problems." Now imagine, decades hence, another thinker, meditating on the disturbing relevance of instrumentarian power, observing that the true problems of our time cannot be understood, let alone solved, without acknowledgement that instrumentarianism became this century's curse, only because it so terrifyingly took care of its problems. What problems? I have argued that surveillance capitalism and its instrumentarian power feed on the volatile conditions of existence that I summarize as the collision. Surveillance capitalism offers solutions to individuals in the form of social connection, access to information, time-saving convenience, and, too often, the illusion of support. These are the resources of the first text. More significantly, it offers solutions to institutions in the form of omniscience, control, and certainty. The idea here is not to heal instability, the corrosion of social trust and its broken bonds of reciprocity, dangerous extremes of inequality, regimes of exclusion, but rather to exploit the vulnerabilities produced by these conditions. It is useful to note that despite the much-touted social advantages of always-on connection, social trust in the U.S. declined precipitously during the same period that surveillance capitalism flourished. According to the U.S. General Social Survey's continuous measurement of interpersonal trust attitudes, the percentage of Americans who think that most people can be trusted remained relatively steady between 1972 and 1985. Despite some fluctuations, 46% of Americans registered high levels of interpersonal trust in 1972, and nearly 50% in 1985. As the neoliberal disciplines began to bite, that percentage steadily declined to 34% in 1995, just as the public internet went live. The late 1990s through 2014 saw another period of steady and decisive decline to only 30%. Societies that display low levels of interpersonal trust also tend to display low levels of trust toward legitimate authority. Indeed, levels of trust toward the government have also declined substantially in the U.S., especially during the decade and a half of growing connectivity and the spread of surveillance capitalism. More than 75% of Americans said that they trusted the government most or all of the time in 1958, about 45% in 1985, close to 20% in 2015, and down to 18% in 2017. Social trust is highly correlated with peaceful collective decision-making and civic engagement. In its absence, the authority of shared values and mutual obligations slips away. The void that remains is a loud signal of societal vulnerability. Confusion, uncertainty, and distrust enable power to fill the social void. Indeed, they welcome it. In the age of surveillance capitalism, it is instrumentarian power that fills the void, substituting machines for social relations, which amounts to the substitution of certainty for society. In this imagined collective life, freedom is forfeit to others' knowledge, an achievement that is only possible with the resources of the shadow text. The private institutions of capital led the way in this ambitious reformation of collective life and individual experience, but they found necessary support from public institutions, especially as the declaration of a war on terror legitimated every inclination to enshrine machine-produced certainty as the ultimate solution to societal uncertainty. These mutual affinities assured that instrumentarian power would not be a stepchild, but rather an equal partner, or even, with increasing regularity, the lord and master upon whom the state depends in its quest for total awareness. That instrumentarian power is regarded as the certain solution to uncertain societal conditions is evident in the ways in which it is called into action by the state. The varied and complex institutional patterns produced by these interactions are a crucial frontier for study and democratic debate. My aim right now is simply to point out a few examples that illustrate the state's continuous demands for the intensification of surveillance capitalism's production of instrumentarian power, expressed in the growth and elaboration of Big Other, as the preferred solution to social breakdown, mistrust, and uncertainty. Although we have become desensitized to a seemingly endless train of such examples, it is important to recognize that in these entanglements, state and market institutions demonstrate a shared commitment to a relentless drive toward guaranteed outcomes. Their mutual affinities can help us define the problem that threatens to make instrumentarian power our century's curse. Unsurprisingly, instrumentarian power is consistently called into action as a solution, if not the solution, to the threat of terrorism. Acts of terror reject the authority of civilizational norms and reveal the impossibility of society without mutual trust. Governments now turn to instrumentarian power as the solution to this new source of societal uncertainty, demanding the certainty machines that promise direct, reliable means of detection, prediction, and even the automatic actuation of countermeasures. During the 16 years of the Bush and Obama administrations, progress in information technology was understood as the most effective response to threat. Peter Swire observes that public officials know that the private sector is developing many new techniques for collecting and processing data and making decisions based on that data. The consequence is a large and ongoing shift toward information-intensive strategies that avail themselves of these market capabilities. This status quo was interrupted in 2013 when Edward Snowden revealed the hidden complicity between state security agencies and the tech companies. In the backlash that followed, surveillance capitalists confronted new public relations challenges in what they portrayed as an uneasy or even unwilling alliance between private power and state security needs. Nevertheless, new terrorist threats invariably orient public officials toward the intensification and deployment of Big Other and the instrumentarian power it signifies. However, their ability to access this immense power is fraught with tension. It is not simply theirs to command. They must work, at least in part, through the surveillance capitalists. For example, in the aftermath of the December 2015 terror attacks in Paris, President Obama, U.S. legislators, and public officials around the world exhorted the tech companies, especially Google, Facebook, and Twitter, to identify and remove terrorist content. The companies were reportedly reluctant to be, or at least to be perceived as, tools of government. Journalists noted that public officials developed workarounds aimed at achieving access to instrumentarian power without imposing new burdens on the company's public standing. For example, a government agency could assert that offending online content violates the internet company's terms of service, thus initiating the quick removal of offending material, without the paper trail that would go with a court order. Similarly, Google expanded its Trusted Flagger program, through which officials and others could identify problematic content for immediate action. The companies responded with their own initiatives. Eric Schmidt suggested new instruments, including a spell check for hate, to target and eliminate terrorist accounts, remove content before it spreads, and accelerate the dissemination of counter-messages. Top Obama administration officials endorsed that prospect on a pilgrimage to Silicon Valley in January 2016 for a terror summit with tech leaders. The agenda included discussions on how to disrupt terror activities on the internet, amplify alternative content, disrupt paths to radicalization, and enable security agencies to prevent attacks. A White House briefing memo encouraged the companies to develop a radicalism algorithm that would digest social media and other sources of surplus to produce something comparable to a credit score, but aimed at evaluating the radicalness of online content. The turn to instrumentarian power as the solution to uncertainty is not restricted to the U.S. government. Terrorism triggers similar responses in Germany, France, the UK, and around the world. After the 2016 attack on a Berlin Christmas market, German officials announced plans to require suspected extremists to wear electronic tags for perpetual tracking. In 2017, surveillance capitalists, including Facebook, Microsoft, Google, and Twitter, established the Global Internet Forum to counter terrorism. The objective was to tighten the net of instrumentarian power through collaboration on engineering solutions to the problem of sharing content classification techniques, counter-speech initiatives, and a shared database of unique digital fingerprints for violent terrorist imagery to accelerate the identification of terrorist accounts. The 2017 joint report of five countries, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States, included four key commitments, the very first of which was engagement with the internet companies to address online terrorism activities and to support the industry forum led by Google and Facebook. That year, the European Council announced its expectation that industry would live up to its responsibility to develop new technology and tools to improve the automatic detection and removal of content that incites to terrorist acts. Meeting in Hamburg in 2017, the G20 countries vowed to work with the internet companies, insisting on the need for better instruments to filter, detect, and remove content, and encouraging the industry to invest in the technology and human capital able to detect and eliminate terrorist activity online. There are other emerging configurations of instrumentarian and state power. For example, former U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told Congress in 2016 that the intelligence services might use the Internet of Things for identification, surveillance, monitoring, location tracking, and targeting for recruitment, or to gain access to networks or user credentials. Indeed, a research report from Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society concluded that surveillance capitalism's wave of smart appliances and products, networked sensors, and the Internet of Things would open up numerous avenues for government actors to demand access to real-time and recorded communications. That smart and connected signal new channels for commercial and government surveillance is neither conjecture nor limited to federal intelligence agencies. In a 2015 murder case, police used data from a smart utility meter, an iPhone 6S Plus, and audio files captured by an Amazon Echo device to identify a suspect. In 2014, data from a Fitbit wristband were used in a personal injury case, and in 2017, police used data from a pacemaker to charge a man with arson and insurance fraud. In the U.S., local law enforcement has joined the queue of institutions seeking access to instrumentarian power. Surveillance-as-a-service companies eagerly sell their wares to local police departments, also determined to find a shortcut to certainty. One startup, Geofedia, specializes in detailed location tracking of activists and protesters, such as Greenpeace members or union organizers, and the computation of individualized threat scores using data drawn from social media. Law enforcement agencies have been among Geofedia's most prominent clients. When the Boston Police Department announced its interest in joining this roster in 2016, the city's police commissioner described to the Boston Globe his belief in machine certainty as the antidote to social breakdown. The attack on the Ohio State University campus is just the latest illustration of why local law enforcement authorities need every tool they can muster to stop terrorism and other violence before it starts. An ACLU attorney countered that the government is using tech companies to build massive dossiers on people based on nothing more than their constitutionally protected speech. Another more prominent surveillance-as-a-service company, Palantir, once touted by Bloomberg Businessweek as the War on Terror's secret weapon, was found to be in a secret collaboration with the New Orleans Police Department to test its predictive policing technology. Palantir's software not only identified gang members, but also traced people's ties to other gang members, outlined criminal histories, analyzed social media, and predicted the likelihood that individuals would commit violence or become a victim. 4. The China Syndrome. It is now possible to imagine one logical conclusion of this trend toward the substitution of certainty for society as the Chinese government develops a comprehensive social credit system described by one China scholar as the core of China's internet agenda. The aim is to leverage the explosion of personal data in order to improve citizens' behavior. Individuals and enterprises are to be scored on various aspects of their conduct, where you go, what you buy, and who you know. And these scores will be integrated within a comprehensive database that not only links into government information, but also to data collected by private businesses. The system tracks good and bad behavior across a variety of financial and social activities, automatically assigning punishments and rewards to decisively shape behavior toward building sincerity in economic, social, and political life. The aim is for every Chinese citizen to be trailed by a file compiling data from public and private sources, searchable by fingerprints and other biometric characteristics. Although China's social credit vision is invariably described as digital totalitarianism and is often compared to the world of Orwell's 1984, it is better understood as the apotheosis of instrumentarian power fed by public and private data sources and controlled by an authoritarian state. The accounts of its pilot programs describe powerful examples of surveillance capitalism's economies of action and the intricate construction of superscale means of behavior modification. The aim is the automation of society through tuning, herding, and conditioning people to produce pre-selected behaviors judged as desirable by the state, and thus able to preempt instability, as one strategic studies expert put it. In other words, the aim is to achieve guaranteed social rather than market outcomes using instrumentarian means of behavioral modification. The result is an emergent system that allows us to peer into one version of a future defined by a comprehensive fusion of instrumentarian and state power. China's vision is intended as the solution to its own unique version of the curse of social dissolution. Writing in Foreign Policy, journalist Amy Hawkins explains that China's pandemic of social distrust is the problem to which the social credit system is addressed as the cure. To be Chinese today is to live in a society of distrust, where every opportunity is a potential con and every act of generosity a risk of exploitation. A fascinating empirical study of social trust in contemporary China actually finds high levels of in-group trust, but discovers that these are correlated with negative health outcomes. The conclusion is that many Chinese trust only the people who are well known to them. All other relationships are regarded with suspicion and anxiety, with obvious consequences for social trust as well as well-being. This rampant distrust, typically assigned to the traumas of rapid modernization and the shift to a quasi-capitalist economy, is also the legacy of Chinese totalitarianism. The Chinese Communist Party dismantled traditional domains of affiliation, identity, and social meaning. Family, religion, civil society, intellectual discourse, political freedom, recalling Arendt's description of the atomization that destroys bonds of trust. As Hawkins writes, "But rather than promoting the organic return of traditional morality to reduce the gulf of distrust, the Chinese government has preferred to invest its energy in technological fixes. And it's being welcomed by a public fed up of not knowing who to trust, in part because there's no alternative. The Chinese government intends to commandeer instrumentarian power to replace a broken society with certain outcomes." In 2015, the Chinese Central Bank announced a pilot project in which the top e-commerce companies would pioneer the data integration and software development for personal credit scoring. Among the largest of the pilots was Alibaba's Ant Financial and its personal credit scoring operation, Sesame Credit. The Sesame Credit system produces a holistic rating of character, with algorithmic learning that goes far beyond the timely payment of bills and loans. Algorithms evaluate and rank purchases, video games versus children's books, education degrees, and the quantity and quality of friends. One reporter's account of her Sesame credit experience warns that the algorithm veers into voodoo, considering the credit scores of her social contacts, the car she drives, her job, school, and a host of unspecified behavioral variables that supposedly correlate with good credit. The shadow text remains out of reach, and users are left to guess how to improve their credit scores, including shedding friends with low scores and bulking up on high-scoring individuals who, some believe, can boost one's own rank. The company's CEO boasts that the scoring system will ensure that the bad people in society don't have a place to go, while good